you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
The Institute of Art and Ideas, articles, videos, and podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, the podcast that brings you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. How can philosophy help us think more clearly? To discuss this question, we're joined this week by world-renowned philosopher of language and logic, Timothy Williamson.
Studying logic, you are actually studying the world in its most abstract and general structural features.
Williamson is the Wickham Professor of Logic at the University of Oxford and is renowned for his work on vagueness and epistemology. He has also written extensively on what philosophy is and how it should be done in works such as Doing Philosophy and The Philosophy of Philosophy.
People tend not to be very good at seeing the faults in their own views, so you have to get somebody else to do it for you.
In our conversation, Williamson discusses a range of issues, including the importance of debate, the logic behind Alan Turing's computer, and why being confused about philosophy can actually be a good thing. Today's interview was recorded on location at How the Light Gets In, the world's largest philosophy and music festival. For more information on the festival, head over to howthelightgetsin.org.
Debating in public is a scary experience because you're putting your ideas on the line, and the whole point of it is that ideas should be properly be tested.
If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter at IAI_TV. Leave a review on iTunes and head over to our website, iai.tv, to hear more from the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. And if you enjoy our podcast, you might also enjoy Philosophy Talk, a radio show, podcast, and online community created by our friends at Stanford University. Head over to philosophytalk.org to check it out. Back now to Timothy Williamson.
Your latest book goes back to the principles underlying philosophy, and philosophy undergraduates are famously quite confused. The more they read, the more philosophy they read, and the more philosophy they try to understand. But philosophy can also clear up our minds, right, and help our organize our minds. So I was wondering, is the confusion part of the solution, or how do the two work?
I don't think being confused is a solution to any problem that I know, but I'm not sure that philosophy students are more confused than students in other areas necessarily. I mean, they're finding the material that they're working with quite difficult to understand because it is very demanding. But at the same time, the fact that they're confused is a sign that they're actually engaging with it properly. I mean, the really bad sign is when you get somebody who sort of quickly skims through pages of difficult philosophy and thinks that they've understood it completely, and that tells you that they've understood nothing at all. So, confusion is a natural reaction to the difficult process of thinking things through in a deeper way than you're used to, and with a bit of luck, it sometimes leads to a much clearer state of mind at the end. And I plenty of students that I teach do get to that kind of clarity about, not about everything, but about quite a lot of things.
So how can philosophy help us think more clearly?
Well, philosophy gives you a kind of toolkit for thinking about issues of a very, very general kind. So that, for example, you learn things like distinguishing between necessary conditions and sufficient conditions, and The sort of things that you just get in the habit when people start talking about one thing being a condition for another. You know, you ask yourself, are they talking about necessary conditions or sufficient conditions? And so you learn to distinguish different things that they might be saying and work out which one they are saying, or maybe you realize that they're confused between the two. And you have a kind of checklist of things that you control for when you're reading, and that kind of brings out the contours of what somebody's saying a bit more clearly than if you just sort of read through it with glazed eyes without very much attempt to kind of analyze it. And it gives you some skill in noticing what assumptions people are making in their arguments, which conclusions and which things they're just conjecturing and which they're asserting. And so, I mean, you just are expected to make these kind of distinctions. I mean, of course, every subject does some of this, but I think philosophy does it a bit more and a bit more systematically than other subjects.
There was a recent study that was showing that actually ethics professors are not necessarily more ethical in their personal lives. And I was wondering whether the same happens with logic professors, that they're not necessarily more rational or more logical in their personal and maybe political lives and beliefs.
Well, I think when you study logic, you realize that there are what the limits of logic are, apart from anything else. And of course, most questions in ethics and politics cannot be solved by logic alone. I think the tendency amongst logicians is, if there's a weakness, it's that they tend to be a little bit paralyzed by questions which can't be solved by logic alone. That doesn't mean that they can be solved by ignoring logic. Logic is often one of the things that you need, at least in dealing with complex problems. I mean, you don't really need it for simple ones. And it's got to be combined with various kinds of knowledge from outside logic. For example, some ability, independently of logic, to recognize at least simple cases of right and wrong if it's an ethical problem.
So logic is one instrument, but it's not the only instrument.
Yeah, absolutely.
To solve those issues, could you give an example of how, for instance, logic is helpful, in a political situation or a personal situation, but it needs something else to adapt to it to actually solve the issue?
The situations that where logic is useful tend to be, and where as where formal logic is useful, tend to be more complex ones. I think rather going into the complexities of particular political problems or whatever, I don't think that if we taught politicians a little bit of formal logic, then they would easily solve the Brexit problem or anything like that. But I think the clearest example of the practical value of logic is that that Alan Turing, who many people know of from The Imitation Game, I mean, he was solving a very abstract problem in logic called the decision problem, and as a result of that, he invented the computer. I mean, initially, just as really as an idea, not as something that existed in concrete reality. But of course, when the Second World War came along and there was a need to break the German codes, he then built a machine according to the abstract design, and that was the origin of the modern computer. So that's a very simple way in which logic has made an enormous practical difference. I can't say that that when I'm solving personal problems, I list some premises and then deduce a conclusion as to what I should do. Its role is a bit more indirect than that.
Is logic then just a tool you use in your work, or does it actually overflow into other fields of your life as well?
Well, I think I don't think of it as just a tool. I think that the principles of logic, they're not just linguistic rules. They're actually, in some way, laws of reality. And so in studying logic, you are actually studying the world in its most abstract and general structural features. So that you know, it's as if you like, logical knowledge is valuable as an end as well as a means. But as my wife would, I think, agree that when it comes to solving my own personal problems, that logic doesn't help very much.
You're a strong believer in debate, in the role of debate in analytic philosophy, and I was wondering if you could make the case for it.
Well, debate arises because people disagree, and then rather than using violence or something to settle their disagreement, we have to in some way compare these opposing views and discover the strengths and weaknesses of them. And I don't think you can really do that without, you know, on the one hand, having people who will prepared to strongly defend a view, and on the other hand, have people who are doing their best to think of objections to it. So and this is what you sometimes see in philosophy conferences and so on. And you know, I mean, there are kind of rules to some extent of you know, fair and foul play in these debates, and it isn't just a matter of it's not to do with personal animus. It's really to do with testing the strengths of a theory, to see what kind of challenges it can overcome, what things it can explain which maybe it initially looked hard to explain, and where it doesn't really have an answer to certain kinds of question. And I think the best way of discovering the strengths and weaknesses is by, as I say, by having people who are strongly motivated on each side to do the, in one case, to do the very best they can for the theory, and in the other case, to do the very worst that they can to the theory. Where, and I think it's just a, you know, a predictable fact about human nature that people tend not to be very good at seeing the faults in their own views, so you have to get somebody else to do it for you.
Or the critics of the debate style of analytic philosophy would associate this culture with a more kind of masculine culture, and they'd say that maybe because of this kind of combative style of analytic philosophy, female philosophers or philosophers from ethnic minorities might feel less confident in joining the debate. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, one thing is that some of the most effective debaters in philosophy that I've known have been women. I mean, people like Ruth Barkin Marcus, Ray Langton, Delia Graff, Farah, Judith Jarvis Thompson, and so on. I mean, they have been really tough debaters. And of course, it's true that for people lacking in self-confidence, it is difficult to put your hand up and ask a question and see what kind of response it gets. And so, I mean, we do have to be careful that the philosophical culture is one where everybody is treated with respect. And one thing that was the case at one time is that the probably the questions asked by women and by people from ethnic minorities were somehow given less weight than questions asked by white men. And I mean, I hope that is just no longer the case. I think there are just too many examples of people who are not white men who are very respected in the profession, and everybody knows that if they ask a question, you really have to be, we're on top form to answer it properly, because it is not going to be an easy question. So, I think that was more a matter of prejudices that were rife in the general culture, not disappearing when you got into the philosophy conference or classroom, and I think although of course those prejudices have not totally disappeared, but I think they're much less prevalent than they were. Of course, I think also that as the proportion of women and people from ethnic minorities in philosophy increases, there's less danger of marginalization. But I think it is also the case that debating in public is a scary experience, because you're putting your ideas on the line, and the whole point of it is that ideas should be properly be tested. But that can mean that your ideas are found wanting in public, and I mean, you'd have to be a very strange kind of person really to enjoy that.
One thing that we ask the speakers at the festival is whether there's an idea that they have recently changed their mind about.
Yes. I'm not famous for changing my mind, but recently I've been working on a book on how conditionals work. These are if-then statements. If something were to happen, what would the consequences be? And until I started really working on this book, I accepted the fairly standard views of these statements, particularly what are called counterfactuals, where you're saying if it were the case, even though in fact it isn't that so and so, what would then be what would then follow? And I've come to the conclusion that actually the standard views are unnecessarily complicated, and that in fact when you really look at the evidence people have been using, some of it doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. These are cases where the kind of judgments that speakers of the language make are, in my view, mistaken for quite explicable reasons. And so I think, in fact, a much much simpler theory of conditionals is possible than the ones that people have been holding. So it's a fairly technical example, but I really have changed my mind about that.
If you were to choose one classic thinker who has really influenced you, and also then if you could speak about like an up-and-coming one or a contemporary one that you really admire and present one of their ideas.
I think there's a lot to be said for Plato, actually. I think he had a feel for how the underlying nature of reality has to be understood in terms of the kind of rigorous structural thinking that you find in mathematics and logic, which of course logic wasn't very developed in his time, but I think the his sense of what kind of thinking would be required to solve philosophical problems pointed in that direction. I mean, one very interesting contemporary thinker of a generation younger than mine is Jennifer Nagel at the University of Toronto, who's doing a lot of the best work in at the moment in connecting issues in the theory of knowledge with the psychological study of the mind and showing how the way in which we think about sort of philosophical thought experiments about which test our analyses of knowledge and that kind of thing actually depends on the basic human mind reading capacities, and so she's using contemporary psychology to cast a lot of light on what's going on in contemporary epistemology.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. It was hosted by me, Catherine Flay, and our guest speaker this week was philosopher Timothy Williamson. To explore more talks and debates, be sure to check out our online library at iai.tv. You can watch Timothy Williamson in conversation with Saul Kripke in our video on language and logic. Or there's The Limits of Language, which asks whether it's possible to find the right words for everything. Please do leave a comment and review on whatever platform you listen on. And tune in next week for more debates and talks from the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.